Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Happy to have Kurt Gray on the podcast. Kurt is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He received his BSc from the University of Waterloo and his PhD in social psychology from Harvard University. He studies the mysteries of subjective experience and likes to wield Occam's razor to defend parsimony, asking whether complex phenomena can be simplified and understood through basic processes. These phenomena include moral judgment, group genesis, and psychopathology. He's been named an APS Rising Star and was awarded the Janet Spence Award for Transformative Early Career Research. He was also given the SPSB Theoretical Innovative Award for the article, Mind Perception is the Essence of Morality. His latest book is The Mind Club, Who Thinks, What Feels, and Why It Matters, co-authored with the late, great Daniel Wagner. Thanks for being on the show, Kurt.
Thanks for having me.
What a fascinating book, you know, that you talk about how you like to wield Occam's razor to defend parsimony. Well, you also, in this book, kind of like, you take all of the greatest life's mysteries and then just like distill it to like, oh, you know, you put too much science in there, I think, where it's like, where's the magic of life? So tell me.
There is a lot of science. We do try to weld in everything from love to falling in love with animals.
Yeah, I mean, the range of topics that you cover in this book is so comprehensive, and you touch on so many big issues in the life of human existence. And I thought we could talk about a bunch of this stuff today.
Yeah.
So the Mind Club. Great. Yeah, the book is called The Mind Club. And you define the Mind Club as that special collection of entities who can think and feel. So in order to have a mind, do you need to satisfy both criteria?
That's a great question. And what we find is actually that there's really two mind clubs. There's a thinking mind club and a feeling mind club. And you know, you and I have both the ability to think and feel, but some things only have one ability. Like animals are often seen to only feel, and corporations, for instance, are seen only to think.
You know, I'm wondering, because like in the field of cognitive psychology, is there a distinction between like emotions, like the study of emotions and the study of mind? The construct of mind in psychology, is it something that does naturally incorporates emotions? Because I've seen it discussed different ways in the field. I've sort of seen it described like the cerebral core, you know, like more of like the higher order processes.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's a really vague concept, what mind is and what emotions are. I mean, there's been debates going on for centuries almost about who has a mind and who has emotions.
Sure.
So I think, you know, we're just defining it in a way that makes it easy for us to kind of look at these different mysteries. And whether emotion's part of mind or different from mind or what have you, it seems almost like a philosophical issue.
For sure, for sure. And you're interested in those issues as well and incorporating that into your work. Let's back up a second and talk about how you met Daniel Wagner and the special bond you guys have and how this book came to fruition.
Yeah, so I actually only met Dan Wagner once I was already his grad student. Seems kind of funny. I was actually traveling in Australia. So after college, I took a year off to go to Australia and surf and pick grapes. And the first time I ever spoke to him was coming back from picking grapes one afternoon, and my cell phone rang and it was Dan. And he said, would you like to come and do grad school with me and explore the mysteries of the kind of human mind? And I said, that sounds pretty amazing. And so, you know, that was in 2004 when I started. And I originally wanted to look at free will. That's what he was doing at the time. But he had done this whole new area of mind perception. And that sounded really interesting, mostly for me because of all the moral questions it brought up. And we had talked a lot about these ideas. And I think he wanted to write a book about them. And he was going to write that book by himself. But in 2010, which is when I graduated, he found out that he had been diagnosed with ALS. And he wondered if I might be willing to help him finish the book if he didn't have time to finish writing it. And, you know, of course, I said, yes, I'd be grateful. And unfortunately, the disease went much faster than we hoped it would. And by the time he was too sick to write, he had kind of written the first chapter and a little bit of the second. Of course, he'd planned out a lot of other stuff, but that's how I got into the book and ended up doing a fair amount of it. But even when I was kind of writing the chapters after he'd passed away, I still kind of had this ability to, of course, perceive Dan's mind and always kind of wonder, you know, is this what Dan would have wanted to say? And most of the time I think, yes, you know, the much of the book is as Dan would have written it, down to the weird jokes and the weird examples. So
I agree. I think he would, you know, he's be very proud of you and this book. So how much of it did he write? How much did he get a chance to see before he passed away? How many chapters?
So he, as I mentioned, he'd kind of written the first chapter and he'd given me feedback on the chapter of The Machine.
Okay.
That's the third chapter. And he kind of looked at my plans for the other ones.
Okay.
But mostly, you know, near the end, he wasn't able to kind of write or read that much. So I would just go up there and sit next to him. We'd look out over the lake through his picture window and I would just kind of tell him what my plans were. And he said, you know, those plans sound reasonable.
Good.
You know, go forth and multiply chapters. And yeah, and it took me about 3 years after he passed away to get it all written up, but it got done.
It did. And it is, like I said, it's a very interesting book. You talk about crypto mines a lot in this book because it's essentially every chapter in another manifestation of a crypto mind.
Yes, that's exactly right. Every chapter is a kind of interesting mind. And a crypto mind is just something that's, you know, that's cryptic to us. We have a hard time understanding whether there's a mind present or not, like an animal or a machine.
Let me jump all the way and we'll work backwards to the self, which is your last chapter. So do we have trouble, you know, I know the answer to this question, but I'm asking a leading question. Do we have trouble understanding ourselves?
Well, yeah, we sure do. I mean,
has anyone ever in the history of the world ever wondered who am I?
I think I'm the first to ever bring up this question. Right. So certainly psychology and philosophy before that have kind of plumbed the limits of our own self-knowledge and wondered what it means to be a person. And so some reviews of the Mind Club say that they're in some ways almost two different books. The first 9 chapters is about all these kind of cryptic minds. And then the last chapter on the self, as you picked up on, is really a kind of brief, fun summary of modern social psychology and how we do or really do not know who we are.
Have you read, I think Bruce Hood wrote it, about how the self is a myth or is an illusion?
I haven't read Bruce's book, no. But Dan has a book, or a chapter rather, called The Self is Magic.
Oh.
Which I imagine is a similar kind of thing, right? It's not a real thing. It's not like a book you can hold.
But it feels so real.
It does, yeah.
And we feel it as a unified whole. Although, you know, I think you asked, and actually in Bruce's book, he asked people to think, close your eyes and try to locate where you think the self is and like kind of draw an X on a cartoon person, a version of a brain to show where it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what scared me about that exercise for me personally is when I closed my eyes, I located it like in multiple areas, depending on what image of myself I thought of. Like I had all sorts of different images. Is that bad? That means I don't have a unified self, or is that normal?
I think I'm not a clinical psychologist, but I'm pretty sure it's normal. I mean, I share your intuition. You know, if I try to pin down the self, I mean, I might not even put the X just in myself, because who I am is determined by my wife and my colleagues, my pets, you know, my work. Maybe I put part of the X in the Mind Club because I poured so much of myself into the book, right? It's hard to pin down.
Absolutely. I mean, our self-concept is constantly changing. I mean, it's good to have a stable source of self-esteem, of course, but we do seem to have all these different aspects. So how does that relate to the mind? How does the self relate to, you know, your main thesis running through this whole book, that mind is a matter of perception? How does that relate to the self?
Well, I think it kind of perfectly relates in some sense, because the self is really a matter of perception. At least in psychology, we kind of understand that the self is a matter of perception. It's something we make. But we often think of the minds of others as something that's really there, right? And, you know, there is an objective fact of the matter, whether your pet can be embarrassed, right? Whether your cat has deep thoughts. But for the most part, the minds of our pets and our machines and dead people and vegetative patients, as you mentioned. It's a matter of perception. And that's something we really stress in the book.
Absolutely. And you talk about implications for lots of things, and we'll get into some of this. So one I want to talk about is morality. So you talk about this phrase dyadic morality, and you talk about it in virtually every chapter. You talk about how it's relevant to the kind of crypto mind you're talking about. So what is dyadic morality, and how does it relate to whether or not something we judge it as immoral or not?
Yeah, so dyadic morality is just the idea that we understand morality in terms of two roles or two minds, right? The word dyad is the Greek word for two. And what it means is when we think of immoral things or moral things, we think of a perpetrator and a victim. That's all it really is. That's what a dyad is. So murder has a murderer and a victim. Abuse has an abuser and abusee. And we take that template to understand kind of everything around us. And the important thing is that those two people aren't just things, but their minds. So an abuser or a perpetrator, we think in terms of responsibility, thinking, right? Kind of planning, intention. Those are what we'd call agency, but you can think of it as really a thinking doer. Right. On the other hand, the victim is a vulnerable feeler, right? We're concerned about their suffering and their feelings. So morality is really about pairing together a thinking doer who causes suffering to a vulnerable feeler. That's all it kind of is.
Yeah, and that distinction explains so much. But can you like pull out the doer as well from the thinker? Like if we talk about like modern dual process theory, like the fact that we have more automatic processes that might not be really thinking. We're not like consciously thinking to do them, but they still do things. Do you know what I mean? Isn't it possible to tease out the doer from the thinker as well?
Yes, certainly you can kind of separate it. But I think when we pass judgments of blame and moral responsibility, we're primarily concerned with the thinking behind the doing. So if you're a sleepwalker or...
Right. That's a great example of an automatic process where we infer mind, even though... And would you say mind is still a part of that, even though it's unconscious?
I think, well, so of course, if you murder someone while you're sleepwalking, as we talk about in the self chapter, then, you know, you're still doing it and there's still, your mind's still involved in some sense, right? Like your brain's making you move and kill someone, but it's not mind in the sense that we normally think of, and certainly not mind in the sense that we think deserves moral responsibility. So in this case of the sleepwalker, you know, everyone acknowledged that he killed his father-in-law, but no one thought that he was responsible. He lacked that kind of thinking part of his mind, even if he was still doing it.
Okay. And this idea of, you know, on the opposite end of the spectrum with the vulnerable feelers, we tend to have the most compassion for them. You know, it's kind of like a ratio. Like if you're much, much more of a vulnerable feeler than you're a thinking doer, we tend to have more compassion for you, it seems like, if you've like faced injustice, for instance, or you're a victim, if you're a victim.
Certainly. Yeah. So people get incensed when people harm babies and puppies and orphans, right? These are all things that we think are very vulnerable and sensitive to pain, but we don't really get upset when CEOs get injured or professional wrestlers get injured, right? So it's really about, you know, this vulnerability, which makes them ideal victims. And then, as you say, makes us empathize with them.
And could that be problematic, though, in the sense that we might not have as much empathy for the people that we've kind of put in the enemy category? Like that maybe we could actually lack our own empathy for them because we do that. Do you know what
certainly.
I mean?
Yeah, certainly. So just because we perceive a mind a certain way, especially when it comes to human minds, doesn't mean that that's true, right? So we can perceive that, you know, a CEO of a Fortune 500 company is cold and calculating and is just doing things for profit. But maybe, you know, he or she is actually very sensitive to criticism and very caring, but their role just prevents us from seeing that. So, all about perception.
It is. Yeah. I mean, there could be certain individuals in the company who could actually have been more innocent than others, but we lump them as a part of the whole group and kind of strip them of their humanity in a way.
Yeah. And on the flip side, we could have a child maybe who we really empathize for.
Like an evil child.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like a devil spawned child. Yeah. And we feel bad for them. But
oh, look how cute they are.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, for sure. my gosh, you really, like, nothing is off limits in this book, you know, like from bestiality to, you know, I mean, it's amazing. So let's talk about bestiality for a second. You know, how does that relate to perceptions of minds?
Well, so it's an interesting topic, right? Because some people, we cover in the book, right? Some people perceive a lot of mind in animal. They fall in love with animals, right? They fall in romantic love with animals and want to express that love. Although, I mean, you'd be surprised at how many people do it, but not enough that I would say it's normal using okay. like a statistical definition of what normal is.
Okay.
But the weird thing from a mind perception's perspective is, why do we think bestiality is so terrible? And probably all our listeners, right, think that's really twisted when people do that. And, you know, certainly it is weird, but it's not clear that the animals necessarily, right, feel as offended as people do. I mean, it's not like animals give consent to sex in the wild to other animals. And so I think what people are really getting angry about is going back to this dyadic morality thing, this imbalance between the person and the goat, let's say, right? So the person is this clearly thinking doer, right? A person can give consent, they can plan, and a goat can't. And so all we think is that they're just vulnerable feelers. And so the example we raise in the book is, imagine how upset you'd be if someone has sex with a puppy. Chances are you'd be pretty upset. But now imagine that someone falls in love and tries to have sex with a hammerhead shark.
Oh, right. So, we wouldn't have as much compassion.
Right. We'd think, wow, that's a weird thing. But, you know, if you can figure out a way, you know, to make love to our great white shark.
In that sense, don't we reverse it and say, like, maybe you're the victim if you get, you know, your bits chomped off?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that's why we don't feel bad for the person, because now they're the victim. So it's all about this ratio, as you mentioned.
It's fascinating. Yeah, especially in the enemy chapter, you talk about how, you know, the dehumanization aspect of what we do to our enemy that strips them of their agency and experience, right? And it's really interesting because, like, you know, we do that like in lots of subtle ways, like even like, you know, with like the person who doesn't like their partner, they think their partner is not spending enough attention on them, and they call them a narcissist, and they say, oh, that person's such a narcissist, you know, my boyfriend or my girlfriend's such a narcissist, or like, you know, so Rich read a really interesting book about that called The Selfishness of Others, which just came out recently, about how we throw these words around that kind of like label the person in a way that strips them of their humanity, and it kind of sometimes make ourselves feel better about ourselves as well.
Yeah, it's very easy to take away mind. I mean, we talk about how easy it is to give mind oftentimes, how easy it is to kind of see your computer as having a mind or your cat as being human, but it's equally easy to kind of strip away mind from people who disagree with us or who make us feel bad about ourselves or who are just different than us, people of different religions or races or what have you.
Are there humans, though, that don't have a mind?
Well, I think
we don't really know if zombies could exist.
Zombies could exist,
philosophical,
right?
Chalmers zombies, yeah.
Right, yeah. Chalmers zombies, for, you know, for listeners who aren't familiar, is this idea of someone who acts and looks and talks just like a person with a mind, but they actually don't have a mind. They're like a Stepford Wife, a very sophisticated robot, you could imagine. So, you know, as you said, it's hard to ever tell if someone's really like that. I think the best contender for someone that doesn't have a mind that's a human is maybe someone in a vegetative state, right? Mm-hmm. Who suffered a lot of brain damage. But someone walking around talking, I think it's a pretty good assumption that they have a mind like you, even if you sometimes ignore it.
Okay. But even people in vegetative states, you know, you talk about the emerging fMRI research or EEG research looking at people in vegetative states. How has that increased our understanding of the presence of mind in such people?
Yeah, it's been actually pretty important, because a lot of these minds of vegetative patients, as we say in the book, are silent. You know, it's very hard to know if someone in a vegetative state has a mind, because they can't tell you about it.
Sometimes I feel like I'm in a vegetative state. Like, do you ever have days where you're trying to work and like nothing is like flowing whatsoever?
Yes.
Why does that happen? Yeah.
I guess that's a matter of perception. Yeah, I think as dense as you feel on those days, I think you're still one up over people who, you know, can't even blink.
Okay, that's totally fair. That's a fair point.
Right. And so there's these people who you're not sure if they are, you know, vegetative, like there's nothing going on in their mind, or they're locked in, right? That there's a mind there, they just can't express it, somehow locked between their limp limbs and their frozen face. And so MRI helps us distinguish that. So you can ask people questions in the scanner. And, you know, to one example is think about playing tennis, or please think about walking around your house. And if you're in a vegetative state, you can't do that, right? You can't respond to those questions. But if you're locked in, if you're still a mind back there, you can. And so these MRI researchers found that a woman they thought was in a vegetative state actually seemed to be locked in, because she could think about playing tennis when she was asked to think about playing tennis, and think about walking around her house when she was asked to do so. So this really kind of flexible behavior really distinguishes the two.
Wow. And fMRI was able to pick up on the relevant brain areas that we know have to do with like spatial navigation and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I think the difficulty with MRI, and why this isn't, you know, like a godsend for having conversations with people, is because the signal's really messy. And you have to ask the question something like 50 times each and average across all those things to see what's happening. So it's not like you get incredible specificity where you can be like, well, think about how you feel about your mother right now. You know, it's not clear what that would be. So it only works in specific circumstances, but still pretty powerful.
Right. We can't read minds yet through fMRI.
That's right. Exactly.
I mean, do you think we'll ever get to that point?
Maybe. There's some researchers who are using EEG, so kind of electrical signals that happen with much faster temporal resolution, not as well spatially, but much faster temporally. And they're trying to get people to do kind of yes-no responses. And some of those seem pretty promising. Another potential way is with the deep brain implants. So you could implant electrodes, which gives you, you know, circumvents the skull being there, which kind of messes up a lot of measurement. So they're all potentials, and I think we'll get there someday, hopefully soon, but these things always take longer.
I mean, couldn't you imagine like a Google Glass type of thing where you, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like science fiction where we actually can read people's minds someday. You know, we have access to their brain scans. It's creepy.
I mean, you could. I just think that the brain isn't very compartmentalized, right? It's all these like different networks on top of each other. And so it's just hard to parse out.
You just know themes. You could be like, Oh, they're in the like sexual, you know, realm right now of what they're thinking, whatever it is, whatever the content is. Or they're navigating something. Or, oh, they're really spending a lot of effort on metacognition because their BA10 is active or something, you know, right? So it's
exactly,
like,
yeah. Exactly. Kind of broad themes. Like the, when they unleashed, I think it was Microsoft or Google unleashed a computer to learn about the internet, which you can imagine is kind of like a mind, this distributed network that thinks about a lot of things. And it came up with like cats and being a jerk, basically like an aggressive person who likes watching things about cats. So maybe
that
we'll do that.
That seems like both extremes of your vulnerable feeling and thinking doer.
That's true, actually. Yeah. Yeah, cats and trolling.
Yeah, that sounds like a great example of each extreme category. Why are humanoid robots creepy?
Ah, yes. Why are humanoid robots creepy? So I think, well, I should say this has been something that's been noticed for maybe almost 50 years now. There was a Japanese roboticist named Mori, and he came up with this idea called the Uncanny Valley. And the idea of the Uncanny Valley is that we generally like robots the more human-like they are, the more they express emotion and feelings. And so that's the kind of left side of a curve that's going up.
But we don't like them to talk back.
Right, right. But you like WALL-E, right? The robot in the animated movie.
Yes.
It's like anthropomorphic, right? Feelings and thinking. But there's a point at which this kind of upward trend of liking robots the more they look human takes a steep drop. And that drop into the canyon or valley is called the Uncanny Valley. And you can find it all over the place. So if you've seen the movie The Polar Express with Tom Hanks, people don't like that because Tom Hanks looks human, but not quite, has these dead gray eyes. Mm. And in fact, Pixar refuses explicitly to do realistic humans because of the Uncanny Valley. So they only do things like animals or very stylized humans like The Incredibles. And so I think, you know, the reason for this, some people have suggested it's just the appearance that creeps us out. But I think really what's going on is perceptions of mind. So we have this in our minds, this big separation between things that should feel and things that shouldn't feel. So you and me, we're okay. Animals, that's cool. But cars and robots, right? They are inanimate. They are made of metal. They should not feel. And so what's creepy is when things that shouldn't feel, like robots, seem to be able to feel because they have a human-like face.
Right.
So we have research suggesting that even if it doesn't have a human face, if I just tell you, look, there's a robot over here. It looks pretty mechanical, but it has this like deep capacity for love and fear and pain. That's pretty unnerving to people.
Yeah, I just Google image Tom Hanks in Polar Express. He looks pretty normal to me. He looks like a real human. Doesn't creep me out.
He's not moving yet, though.
Oh, okay. Maybe we need to watch the video of it then. Okay.
Yeah, his eyes kind of track strange. Oh. It's really all in the eyes. We take people's faces and remove the eyes, which is kind of weird. But people get super creepy if you take their eyes out, and they don't if you take their nose out, for instance. They just look kind of silly with their nose.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah, the eyes convey so much social information.
And so much emotion, right? So much feeling is in the eyes. We think of the mouth as smiling, but it's really in the eyes.
So true. So fascinating. Let's talk about death. Why not? Okay. We talk about this. So what's the chances that, you know, when you die, your mind is gone forever?
Well.
will you give us some hope?
I'd say it's a non-zero chance. That's, okay. You know, that's something.
Okay. You're doing a little Pascal's wager here.
That's right. That's right. You never know. But I think what's the chances that we continue to perceive someone's mind after they pass away?
Right.
That's very, very high.
That is high. And yet we perceive ghosts all over the place, right? Why do ghosts always have unfinished business, for instance?
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, all these are outgrowths of how we perceive minds of the living. And certainly, there's this effect called the Zeigarnik effect in real life. And what it is unfinished business is always more strongly activated in your mind. So if you're driving to work in the morning and you're listening to something in the car and you get out of the car and you haven't finished the song yet, then that's the song you're going to find yourself singing all day, right? Because it's like you haven't gotten to the end. It just keeps kind of in your mind, right? Or if you like
want to... Isn't that how seduction works as well? Like, people really like people they can't have, or people really like people who, like, you know, like are kind of a little standoffish, as opposed to like, I really love you. I really love you. I really want you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, I mean, if you want to talk about seduction, the greatest unfinished business, right, is when you are about to have sex with someone and you get stopped just a little bit short, right?
Yes.
Because then you're like, you're so aroused and you're so excited and you're so anticipating this. And then all of a sudden it stops.
Right.
And so, this is the same thing with ghosts in some sense, right? We think about a mind who's ceased to exist, but they just have one more thing left to finish. And because we can just can't imagine leaving something before we finish it, like sex, for instance, right. We can't imagine someone leaving to the afterlife until their work is done.
And you've actually done the study that people who die when they're in a state of alertness we perceive their mind more. Is that right?
That's right. Yep. So we're actually writing that up now in a paper. And the idea is that we again perceive the minds of the dead as if they were in life, but really as if they were in life the moment before they died.
Wow. So like the Kurt Cobain and people who were in that club, what is it, 27 Club?
The 27 Club, yeah.
You make an interesting point. Like if Kurt Cobain was still alive, or let's say he becomes 80 years old and then he's like barely able to make it on stage, you know, to play, and his playing release is bad at age 80, whatever, and then he dies at age 85, will we tend to remember, will we not like idolize him as much, you think, than if he died at 27?
I doubt it. I mean, Jimi Hendrix and Amy Winehouse and Janis Joplin, right? All sorts of folks who are kind of immortalized in our minds about music. Buddy Holly, right? I mean, we all understand the Rolling Stones are a huge deal, and we understand like the Beatles are a huge deal, but it's really like Lennon that we like pine after. Right, when Ringo's 90 and in some nursing home in London, you know, just be like, wow, yeah, he used to be Ringo. But it's not the same effect of punch because he didn't end when he was famous.
Wow. Okay, so we're not advocating that you kill yourself at a young age.
That's true.
By any stretch of the imagination. But the research suggests that if you want to be remembered, as go down as a legend, whenever you die, be in a, as a, you know, alert as possible, or as a, you know, kind of like in the middle of like a masterpiece.
Yes, that's true.
Is that right?
I don't know. I mean,
is this really taboo? This is like the most taboo ridden like podcast chat I've ever had.
I think, you know, even if you're not doing some great creative work, you know, you could die at the peak of your creative output. That's probably the best way to be as famous as possible. But if you're not doing some great creative work, then just make sure when you die, you've got your eyes open and you're awake, right? It's a simple study. We basically ask people to say how much mind does someone have after their death when they die while asleep or in a coma or while awake and fully alert. And if you die while you're awake and fully alert, people think you have more personality after death. And I think it's more important to follow the wishes of your will, which I think is pretty interesting. Because I think, you know, you still care about it versus if you died while you're in a coma, then they think, well, whatever, we can ignore his last wishes.
Exactly. Yeah. People go to such lengths to follow people's last wishes, even if it like sacrifices the living, you know, like, no, we can't, you know, we got to honor that his last wish to cut down that center, you know, even though it'll keep all those people out of jobs, you know, like.
Yeah, totally. Because we still think that person still cares about it in some ways. Whereas if you think about it, right, like if you're, let's say you believe in heaven and hell, like if you're in heaven, you're having incredible joy and bliss being reunited with God. You're not going to care about something so petty as, you know, to build this fence or to keep this building around. And if you're in hell, well, then you're in eternal suffering and you really don't care about some fence because you're in pain all the time. And so it seems like there's no real, you know, account where people would care that much about what they cared about in life as in death.
But, so where do we go when we die? There's a very banal possibility that we don't go anywhere, right? And that's like the most horrifying thing for people to think. You know, it's like people really don't want to accept that possibility, is that we don't actually go anywhere. The we, which is mostly what the mind is, really what is who we are, just ceases to exist for eternity, but it doesn't go anywhere. That'd be the scariest thing, right?
Right, our consciousness is annihilated, but
forever.
You know, yeah, forever.
Or maybe like the way the universe works is it loops back on itself at some point. Like, you know, eternity is a really long time. Like maybe like the laws of physics don't work that way. Maybe it's actually a continual loop or something. We'll never know till, you know, it happens. But isn't that possible?
I mean, all these things are definitely possible. I mean, some people say like, why would I fear the world after my death? I don't fear the world before my consciousness, right? So, I mean, it actually doesn't seem that funny to me, because before you were born, you were, you know, you didn't have a full self. By the end of death, you've got a full self and you've done all these amazing things. So, I mean.
But, you know, if the Big Bang is right, in the sense that like we don't have free will and everything was determined in that moment, then isn't it technically true that like before we were born, there still was like a destiny of what that self would end up to be someday?
So, yes, I think.
Why are we not smoking pot right now?
That's right. Listening to some Doors. And...
For the record, I do not smoke pot. That was a joke. I just want to say that.
But it's definitely not predictable what you're going to end up be. So even if the universe is determined, you know, you don't know what's going to happen next week or a year from now. And so you might as well try your best to...
Right. But someone would know. Or not someone. I mean, I'm inferring the mind, you know, but... You know, the whole God, you know, God is fascinating. Like you argue in the chapter on God. And I was going to ask you, does God exist? Because I feel like these are just like, I just want to ask you all these questions. Like, what happens when we die? Does God exist? And I feel like you've answers to all these things. So does God exist?
Well, many people would definitely perceive him to exist.
Exactly. That's
certainly more people perceive him to exist than people who perceive him not to exist. So that's something.
And it might not even be a him.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. Or even have a gender. I mean, could. You know, but it seems kind of offensive.
I don't want to offend God, but it's fascinating because we infer, not only do we infer, but we, you know how like we talk about, you know, like when we're, you know, childhood trauma and then we end up projecting things onto people in our relationships. Well, God's like the ultimate projection. Every one of us kind of projects onto God to be whoever kind of create out of our own image, as opposed to God create us in his or her image, right?
Yeah, especially with morality. So you mentioned, you know, smoking marijuana. And there's a researcher named Nick Epley who has this wonderful study and asks people, you know, do you think it's immoral or permissible to smoke marijuana? And what do you think God thinks about that?
Yeah.
And people think that God thinks the exact same thing as they do, especially with moral things.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, that just makes so much sense. So, Yeah, my gosh, so many implications there, but there's almost so much we could talk about today. But my God, there's this, I just said my God. So returning to death for a second, there are people who are trying to kind of try this experiment of cryogenics, right? Mm-hmm. It's a scientific experiment, whether or not there will be facilities in the future that would allow us, that would not consider us dead in the sense that we consider ourselves dead now. And, you know, like 100 years ago, we declared people dead. And for things that we could actually, now we have the technology to keep their lives going, continuing, right? So right. What do you think the feasibility and possibility of cryogenics are? It sounds to me like it's actually quite reasonable in the sense of like, you know, you have 100% chance of not existing forever versus some non-zero chance of there being some technology in the future. So I'm actually intrigued by cryogenics. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I am also actually very intrigued by cryogenics, and out of any sense of immortality, that's the one that also appeals the most to me. And I think it's very...
Do you want to be in the same canister as me?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. As long as it's a big canister.
Yeah. Let's fit some other people in there too.
I think, you know, it's very easy to free someone. I think the difficulty is unfreezing them and having them be alive again, because, you know, you only freeze them once they're already dead by some problem. So maybe the best way to go about it is to freeze us before, you know, we're dead. But
it's not legal yet. But I have been thinking that is like that makes the most sense. Like if you want to like maximize the chances that you're going to live like an extended life, like there's a good chance that like let's say 5,000 years from now, the life extension will probably be, I'm just predicting, it'll be much more than 80 years. And like let's say we froze you at age like 20. Yeah, I guess, but then you take the huge risk. This is the point you're making, is you still take a... It's still not guaranteed that we'd be able to unfreeze you, even though you were alive when we freezed you, correct?
Right. And
so that's a big risk.
Yeah.
As opposed to guaranteed to at least live longer than 20, yeah.
Right. And you need to think of like the motivation for society at the time, right? Like 80 years from now, no one's going to know who you are.
Correct.
Like 200 years, like why do we have to unfreeze this guy?
Great point. Yeah, we're assuming that's a big assumption that 5,000 years from now, you know, anyone will like go back to that canister and be like, oh, we forgot about these people.
Right. And like, yeah. Let's spend a ton of money making their consciousness on the internet or, you know, feeding into robots or something that'll just be like, yep, let's just unthaw them and throw them out.
No, for sure. But doesn't it seem seems kind of unfair that like we just happen to be born. We didn't choose what epic of the universe we were born. We were luckier than those who were born like, you know, 1,281, you know, in terms of life. I'm just talking strictly in terms of life expectancy.
Right.
But, you know, like, what if we knew that like 5,000 years from now, people live as long as they wanted to live in a healthy way? It kind of doesn't that it's like, darn it. You know, do you know what I mean? Like, darn it. We were born in the wrong.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean? Does anyone ever think of this or is this just me?
No, I think they do. I mean, every time I think of, you know, young kids, I just think, you know, your life expectancy
yeah. Will
already be higher than mine.
I think of that too. Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to outlive my parents, hopefully, or my grandparents, hopefully. Right. So it's always getting better. So I think the key in life is probably just to do downward comparisons to make yourself feel better, whether that's in terms of longevity or income or whatever.
Sure. Well, what a fascinating conversation. I think we can probably stop there. And thanks for writing this book and offering such fascinating insights on the mind and everything else that's taboo in this world.
Thanks for having me. It was a fun conversation.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.